I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Michael Gillespie, professor of political science and philosophy at Duke University. Gillespie works on political philosophy with particular emphasis on modern continental theory from Kant through Heidegger. He is the author of Hegel, Heidegger, and the Ground of History, Nihilism Before Nietzsche, and the Theological Origins of Modernity. First of all, let me say thank you so much, Michael Gillespie, for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
So, Michael, this is a great book. It was a sweeping analysis of Nietzsche's late period philosophy, what you call his final teaching. I thought it was really helpful in showing how all the famous pieces of his thought fit together, which is something that I don't think the literature does that well, which tends to focus on one piece, on the will to power, or the Übermensch, or something like that. But you show how they all fit together and that the eternal recurrence is in some sense the central teaching or the teaching that holds the other views together. So let me say, first of all, thank you for writing the book. I enjoyed reading it, and I expect many others will too.
Well, thank you.
So let me ask you first about the motivation for writing the book. You've written about Nietzsche before. Why did you return to Nietzsche now, and why did you focus on his final teaching?
Well, as I say in the book, I began looking at Nietzsche 45 years ago when I was a freshman in college, and I was so taken up with the question that it seemed, he seemed to be an enchanter. And I found out recently when I was talking to Dennis Donahue, who's a scholar of Irish literature, that Yeats had a similar experience when Yeats first got the English, the abysmal English translations of Nietzsche in 1905. He spent 2 years doing nothing but reading Nietzsche, who he constantly referred to as the enchanter. So I think that this experience that people have of reading Nietzsche, especially when they're young, is really something that is remarkable and enchanting for many people. Over time, as I tried to come to teach you to terms with Nietzsche and teach Nietzsche over the course of my career, I've rethought a lot of my initial attraction to Nietzsche and wondered what it was that really inspired. I found so inspiring about Nietzsche. But when it comes down to it, I think this is just a question I've been wrestling with for a long time. And I've never dealt with exactly directly. I published a book on Nietzsche's New Seas with Tracy Strong, which is really a collection of essays, and a book called Nihilism Before Nietzsche, which ends with a short discussion of Nietzsche. But I thought finally it made sense to try to pull all of these things together and come to terms with Nietzsche, not necessarily in a final way. I won't say this is my final teaching on Nietzsche, but to try to at least put in one place what I saw as sort of essential to Nietzsche's thought.
It struck me, at least for this reader, one of the most important contributions of the book is to demonstrate that there's a kind of unity to Nietzsche's thought. I mean, we tend to think of Nietzsche as one of the great anti-systematic thinkers. That Nietzsche wrote a bunch of these scattered aphorisms, and that there's a sort of disorder to them. But one of the main points I think in your book is that you demonstrate that his thought has a kind of comprehensive wholeness or unity to it. And the book outlines that whole in a very clear and powerful way. And it focuses on the eternal recurrence. So I thought maybe what we could do is start with that idea, the eternal recurrence, sort of talk through that and see why on your view, it constitutes the sort of centerpiece of Nietzsche's final teaching. So maybe you could start by saying a bit about how the idea of the eternal recurrence came to Nietzsche. You sort of describe it vividly in the introductory chapter, but maybe start by talking about how it came to him and then how that changed his views.
Well, there are historically, we know that the first time he visited Sils Maria, this beautiful little town close to San Moritz in Switzerland, with his friends Paul Ray and Lou Salome, he was walking around the Lake Silva Plana, and close to a great pyramidal rock, he had this momentary insight about the doctrine of the eternal recurrence. And now the doctrine itself is obviously not new. This is something that was characteristic of lots of ancient thinking. It has persisted time and time again. Many scholars have tried to look for the origin of this. We see Dostoevsky considers it at one point and rejects it as a possibility. But for Nietzsche, it seemed to solve a whole variety of problems that he had recognized in his earlier thought, and that led to what he came to call nihilism. His own account of this is really contained in a variety of different places, principally for most readers in Ecce Homo, where he describes this, but also in Twilight of the Idols, where he characterizes himself in his soul as the teacher of the eternal recurrence, as the principal way in which he has come to think about himself. Now, that said, that certainly wasn't true of Nietzsche's earlier thinking, right? In his early period, he tended to be more romantic and communitarian. In his middle period, he tended to be more of an experimentalist like Montaigne or La Rochefoucauld. He abandons those positions. And I think it has often been the case that people have a lot of trouble understanding why he abandoned those positions, because they seem so much more appealing to us today than his final, more tragic position. And what I try to show in a discussion of the new prefaces that are a revision to his earlier works that he wrote in 1886 is that he thought that his earlier positions all led to first pessimism and then ultimately to nihilism. And he thought that this was a pathway that all of Europe would have to follow, and that the only solution to that, in his view, was his final teaching, the doctrine of the eternal recurrence.
So the usual reading, as I understand it, from the Nietzsche literature is to see the eternal recurrence as in some sense of a myth that's meant for some kind of salutary psychological function, right? So I mean, you in your reading of the early iteration of the eternal recurrence, earliest iteration in the gay science, he sort of says this: imagine that a demon came to you at night and blah blah blah, and that you know, so readers tend to think of the eternal recurrence along those lines. But you sort of admit that the eternal recurrence, on his view, does have psychological benefits, but you also want to sort of defend it as something that Nietzsche himself so genuinely held as an ontological doctrine. Is that right? I mean, what?
Yes.
So what's the, where do you glean that? Yeah, go ahead.
The best, you know, I came to that idea by looking pretty carefully at Nietzsche's letters and the comments of his closest friends. And we know when he first had this idea, he imparted it only to a very few people, including Lou Salome, who describes it as if she were being initiated into a secret society. You know, he would discuss this over dinner and whisper the idea to people, because he thought it would have such a disastrous and world transforming effect upon people. So I think in the first instance it was just the incredible reverence with which Nietzsche treated the idea, but also the the fear that it evoked in him, because he recognized that it, I mean, he thought, if properly understood, it would have a disastrous consequence upon most people, and that it would strengthen another group of people. Now, why that is goes to the heart of his analysis of nihilism in the first instance, and the way in which the eternal recurrence is a solution to that. So for him, at least as he describes it in the quasi-autobiographical prefaces to his new work, to his older works that he wrote in 1886, he seems to think that, in a sense, everything ends in radical pessimism. And here he's thinking particularly of Schopenhauer, and the way in which Schopenhauer's thought led to what he sometimes calls resignationism, or absolute resignationism, the notion that we are in control of a world will that is malign at best, and that cares nothing for us, and that there's no solution in this life other than a kind of religious asceticism and resignation. Nietzsche thought in his early work, especially in the early period when he was more coordinated with Wagner, that this was could be the core of tragic art that would provide a new mythology for German nationalism. He came to see that that was untenable, partly because of the failure of the Wagnerian spiritual project, but also just because of his own personal experience of pessimism. And he came to believe that, and to see, I think quite rightly, that to overcome absolute pessimism, one needed to affirm everything. And that such an affirmation really involved an affirmation of not only the good things of in life, but all of the most horrible, terrible things that had ever happened. The way, as you point out, he puts it in the Gay Sciences, assume a demon comes to you and tells you all of the worst things that you've ever experienced, you have to experience over and over again eternally. And he sees two possible responses to that. The first is to absolutely reject that possibility and say, no, I'd rather die now. And the other, and he saw that as the unhealthy alternative. The healthy alternative is to say, yes, I want that over and over and over again. Now, what Nietzsche imagined those horrible experiences to be in the first instance were, as it appears in the Gay Sciences, something very personal. Probably what he gives us a hint of this in Ecce Homo, and we know this from some of the fact that his sister excised this section from the original manuscript of Ecce Homo. What he really means is, I have to be born with my mother and my sister again, right? And I have to put up with them. And particularly with his sister marrying Germany's leading anti-Semite, who he completely despised. So I think that was the way it appeared to him in the first instance, in his immediate experience of it. As he thought the idea through, he came to realize that it meant affirming not just everything that occurred in his life, but everything that had ever occurred, however awful it would be, and that to say yes, and not only everything that had occurred, but everything that would occur. So to say yes to the doctrine of the eternal recurrence is to be thoroughly affirmative, and to free oneself from the massive weight of the past, of what he calls the it was, the dead hand of the past, and to be active as opposed to merely reactive. And in that respect, however, it requires actually willing everything that has occurred or that will occur. And by willing, he means not just saying, okay, this is necessary because there is something wonderful that it will produce in the end. That's the alternative that Goethe presents in Faust. Faust is willing to say, verweile doch, du bist so schön, linger moment, you are so beautiful. And to justify all of the rest of the existence on the basis of that one beautiful moment. For Nietzsche, that's not enough. For Nietzsche, it's necessary to affirm even the horrible, ugly moments, the horrible experiences of humanity, and to accept those as necessary in order to affirm existence as a whole.
I'm trying to think here, you know, so what is the central problem or issue that the eternal recurrence is a solution to? So is it sort of Schopenhauerian pessimism, or is it, I mean, you suggest at one point in the book, which is sort of interesting reading, I'm very sympathetic to, that it's a way to sort of reconcile freedom and necessity, right? So one of the problems that Nietzsche faces throughout his career is how to sort of generate, a self-determining philosopher of the future, or Übermensch, on the basis of a thoroughly determined universe, right? So every time you try to introduce something new in the world, it turns out that, right, we're the product of an eternal chain of causes that stretches back in the past. And so we actually, we're sort of determined by the order of the universe in the past. I mean, what's your general, when you think about, sort of what are the sort of philosophical inspiration, I guess, for the eternal recurrence, what's the central issue there?
Well, I think Nietzsche recognized what I think is correct, that the problem that modernity, not just modernity, but also Western thought as a whole, really rests upon a contradiction, which is we imagine that nature is an order that works according to some law or system that governs the motions of things, whether that is a notion of mechanical causality or teleological causality, or in our current frame of mind, quantum theory that's based upon a notion of probability. All of them rest upon some notion of causality that is universal and offers no space for human freedom. Human freedom is, however, another concept that has since, certainly at least since the time of Cicero and later Augustine and later Luther and Erasmus, has been a cornerstone of the debate between what it means to have human dignity and what it means just to be another piece of nature. Nietzsche recognized that what had happened, certainly since the Enlightenment, since someone like Lamettrie wrote a book called Man is Machine, and since Darwin, is that human beings who had previously been thought of as the imagio Dei, as somehow between God and nature, had ceased to play that role. That what Darwin had demonstrated was that human beings were simply animals like all other animals, and had come about not through some divine purpose, but simply as a result of random causes over a long period of time. If we were to spring forward and extend that even further, we might conclude with molecular biology that human beings are not only not something higher than animals, but that we're really not essentially different than inanimate nature. We're just a group of self-replicating proteins, or as Alex Rosenberg has argued, we're just a bunch of fundamental particles that have organized themselves in a particular way, and that there's no such thing as human freedom. I think Nietzsche, like Kant, felt that you couldn't have a coherent explanation of the world according to causality without some notion of a first cause. because in that situation you fell prey to the principle of sufficiency, that you couldn't have a cause if you said this is all of this is a result of a natural cause, but there was a previous cause that went back and forward, as far as you could go. And we see that in modern science, which imagines that there is that they can explain everything in terms of, you know, whatever you want to call it, the Big Bang. But if you look at current cosmological thinking about that, it becomes simply what they call a quantum anomaly, which is not really an explanation. It is, you know, at a certain point in time, a miracle occurred. And Nietzsche recognized, like Kant did, that can't give us a final explanation, that you need a first cause or something like a first cause. And that's something through freedom. And not only is it necessary to have freedom as the beginning of a first cause, but it's necessary to have freedom as the basis for human dignity. On the other hand, if there's freedom, how can there be any order to nature, any kind of causality that governs things? And so what Nietzsche tries to do with the doctrine of eternal recurrence from a metaphysical point of view is to argue that each of us is, we can't will backwards, we can't change the past, but we can only will forwards. But insofar as the future is also the past, everything that we will is part of what will and has occurred. And as a result, we can be both free and determined, but determined as self-determining, not determined from the outside by some force that is independent of us. So in that sense, the doctrine of the eternal recurrence ends up being a kind of deification of those who are able to affirm it. And in that sense, the foundation for the notion of the superhuman as he understands it.
Right. It's a sort of the snake biting its own tail type idea that every end is also a beginning. I mean, it also reminds me in a different way of somebody like Leibniz, who I think you also allude to in connection with Nietzsche. So for Leibniz, every monad is a reflection of the whole and contains within it the whole. And so, you know, there's something similar, it seems, in Nietzsche's view that, you know, he's at least pointing towards an ideal character who himself can affirm or will enhance, embody, and express the whole. And that's in a way, you know, that's the route to a kind of self-determination or autonomy as in the sort of Kantian way. Is that,
yeah,
I mean, is that similar? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I would push it back even farther onto a kind of Neoplatonism. The sense that the Neoplatonist had that everything was, to go back to Plotinus, that everything was an emanation of the one, and that we needed finally to recognize our unity with the one. And I think that's part of what the doctrine of the eternal recurrence is. Then that's a repeated trope that we see in Western thought. I mean, certainly with Hegel, that's, you know, it's completely obvious, in Leibniz as well. But also in Spinoza and others, it is how do we bring ourselves back into unity with the wholeness of things? It's obviously also a Christian trope and the notion of seeing, now through a glass darkly, but at some point in the future, to use Dante's example, being part of the rose that is part of God. So, you know, I think that's now Nietzsche tries to spell out how that happens, not merely, I think, intellectually, although intellectually that's obviously, it psychologically is very important for him, but what that can mean concretely in terms of the transformation of human society.
Yeah, I think that's the place to go now, because I mean, much of the book is a really nice spinning out of the implications of the eternal recurrence and, you know, practically, but also how it informs and grounds his anthropology, his view of the new logic, as you say. So I thought we could shift over to his new anthropology, which sort of follows from his eternal recurrence, which you take up in the first part of the book. And that is comprised in your view of his Nietzsche's view of nihilism and his view of the Übermensch. So maybe we could start off by talking about his view of nihilism, which you've done a lot of work on. You have a book, as you said, Nihilism Before Nietzsche. And so you connect Nietzsche back to this tradition of nihilism, which started in the classical German philosophical period. You connect Nietzsche back to Fichte and the German romantics. Could start off by saying a little bit about what Nietzsche means by nihilism and how it sort of flows from, it's connected to his broader eternal recurrence project.
Yeah, well, let me first say, and sort of a little bit about the background of nihilism, to make Nietzsche's innovation clear. The term was around, the term took on its 19th century meaning when Jacobi criticized Fichte as a nihilist. And what he meant by that was that Fichte, insofar as he absolutized human will, was doing away with any space for God. So that the problem of nihilism, as the earlier 19th century understood it, was a problem of a certain kind of Prometheanism. If you assume the human will was absolute, you removed any space for God. Nietzsche, in a certain sense, reverses that notion and argues that the problem that faces humanity is not the Prometheanism or the absolutizing of the human will, but the weakening of the human will. And he sees this as essential to Christian democratic societies. And it produces what he calls the last man, the man who's incapable of love, incapable of wonder, incapable of awe, who really spends his or her life as, you might almost say a mall rat, a consumer who's driven by momentary preferences rather than by any final goal to life. Now, in order to understand why Nietzsche thinks that, let me say a few words about his psychology. Nietzsche imagines, and here he's very much dependent upon Schopenhauer, Nietzsche imagines that human beings aren't, that there is no such thing as the soul. There's only something called the self. And when you look carefully at what he means by the self, it's quite different, for example, than what Hegel imagined the self to be. It is just the collection of passions that make up humanity and human beings. And each human being is a kind of chaos of these passions, and those passions need to be organized for human beings to have any real to accomplish anything. A lot of that is done by habituation, as Aristotle made clear. But habituation depends upon the particular values of any given society. And insofar as those values structure the way in which we habituate ourselves, they make it possible for us to do things other than simply be motivated by our momentary desires. For example, young children, as you know, when they're born, want to eat about every 20 minutes. And it takes a long time to convince them to convince their bodies to spread out the time of their eating so that parents can get a good night's sleep. Sometimes people are more or less successful at that, but ultimately we make that possible. We habituate children in all kinds of other ways as well. We teach them what's right and wrong. We teach them, how to tie their shoes, all kinds of things that they have to learn over time that bring them into the particular culture within which we live. And hopefully we do that in ways that make it possible for them to be successful within that culture. The cultures themselves depend, however, upon a belief in certain notions of good and evil, or good and bad, in Nietzsche's view. And insofar as we become nihilistic, we lose our faith in all of the values that help to structure the society within which we organized the patterns of habituation that made it possible for us to control the passions. Nietzsche thought that the particular order within which European society had developed was an order established by Christianity, and that the habituation of our passions all depended upon a belief in a divine law. And insofar as the notion of God became untenable and unbelievable, the entire structure of European morality was called into question. And we see this in the fifth book, the beginning of the fifth book of the Gay Science, which was written quite late in 1887, in which Nietzsche lays out what he calls the greatest event, which is the death of God. And it's the death of God because it's the greatest event because it leads to the collapse of European morality and what he calls the advent of a monstrous logic of terror. So what Nietzsche believes is, so the problem of nihilism is not just, from his point of view, an intellectual problem. It's not just existential angst. It is something that affects the way in which we organize our bodies and the passions within our bodies in ways that are coherent. Under conditions of nihilism, he believes that what he sometimes calls the hierarchy of the passions, or the rank order of the passions, is dissolved, and we become what he calls last men, the last human beings closest to the animals. We're driven simply by our momentary passions. And those momentary passions have no order. They don't reinforce one another. They're not put in service of any particular goals. Therefore, what he believes is necessary in order to overcome this nihilism is a new set of values, or what he comes to call in the late period of his thought, a revaluation of all values, right? A reestablishment of goals and purposes for humanity. So, for example, in Zarathustra, he has one section that is called 1001 Goals in the Kaufman translation, which probably really should be translated the 1000 Goals and the One Goal. And he argues that previously there have been 1000 different kinds of societies, cultures, that have all inculcated particular codes of values, but never has there been a code of values for all of humanity. And that's what he sees finally, the 1001st goal as being, and that's the goal of the Superman that he articulates in his late thought.
Perhaps we could talk about the Superman or the Übermensch. You devote the next chapter to the Übermensch. You connect it again back, the Übermensch, back to the earlier romantic thought, whether in sort of Lord Byron or Fichte or Carlyle. A lot of these thinkers sort of had a kind of Promethean figure in mind as a sort of redeeming figure in the collapse of European morality, as you sort of outline in the, so a lot of this was sort of in the air in 19th century philosophy, the sort of collapse of a moral order from the collapse of the death of God and the need for, or sort of longing for, particular great individuals to sort of shore up something new. So in your view, what makes Nietzsche's view distinct from those earlier iterations of this?
Well, yeah, it's obviously, and you're absolutely right that there are lots of earlier iterations of this, and not just among romantics, but also if you think of John Stuart Mill's notion of the individual and on liberty, which Nietzsche read and commented on in his Marginalia extensively. There's this notion that somehow progress is achieved by allowing people who fall outside of the norm to have space in which to develop. Mill thinks that that can be done peacefully through toleration, and the two examples that he uses over and over again are Christ, Socrates, and Galileo, all of whom are punished for what they've done. And Mill seems to think that the world would be a whole lot better place if we tolerated all kinds of strange people, because some of them would be very helpful to us. So this notion of progress that it characterizes this, both I think the liberal tradition and the romantic tradition, is not one in which we see incremental progress in the way that Bacon imagined science would take place, by dividing labor, by having people work individually, by publishing and communicating their results. It is this notion that human progress really is the consequence of the work of geniuses. Now, the term genius, as certainly as Nietzsche understands it, and I think as it's properly understood, is not meant to mean somebody who is just radically more intelligent than other people. It's meant, and he uses the Greek term here, it's really meant to imply and to point towards those people who are one with genesis, with becoming, with the genesis of things. And so insofar as the genius understands those things, he's able to come to terms with the world in a different way than most of us do. So the first thing I think that characterizes Nietzsche's Superman is a kind of oneness with the world. And we see that already in his first work, The Birth of Tragedy, in which he talks about the world poet, the lyric poet who when he says I, is not really speaking for himself personally, but for the spirit of the world. That's a trope that characterizes lots of early 19th century thinking, and I think Nietzsche adopts that in his earlier thought. He comes to realize, however, I think in his later thought, that for that to be true, it's not just enough for the genius to understand the world. The genius has to actually affirm the genesis, the becoming of things. And that this affirmation means affirming everything that has occurred, and therefore affirming the kind of nihilistic thought that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, and I mean, that's helpful to sort of connect the Übermensch to the world at large, because I mean, one of the sort of brings some of the alternative readings of the Übermensch into play here. I mean, from the scholarship, because you're sort of interpreting the Uberman in a particular way. I mean, there's a way in which scholars have tried to defang or domesticate the Ubermensch in various ways. I think one of the more popular ones is to see, and this is connected with scholars like James Conant and Stanley Cavell, is to see sort of Nietzsche's self-overcoming, which is always on the way towards in some kind of regulative ideal of the Übermensch, as in some way connected to one's own personal self-realization, right? So it attempts to turn, I think, Nietzsche into somebody like a John Stuart Mill, mm-hmm. right? Where you want to, I think, keep them separate. And I think this is a helpful reminder of the way in which for Nietzsche, you know, the Übermensch is in some way I think you call it the world poet, right? So like evokes Walt Whitman in certain ways. There's a kind of music, you know, the Overman's music is connected with the music of the world. Maybe you could say a little bit, I don't know if you want to say a little bit about your view of the Übermensch and how it's sort of contrasts with or challenges some of the more democratic or liberal readings of Nietzsche.
Well, Nietzsche, yeah, that's a very good question. And one that I try to clarify in the book. The Democratic reading of the Übermensch imagines him, and let me just be upfront about this. I much prefer the Democratic reading
right.
in reality.
Yeah, we all do. Yeah,
the one that Nietzsche presents. But it's important to see what Nietzsche actually seems to me what Nietzsche actually says in order to understand the tremendous impact that he had. The first I have to say, earlier in my life, I preferred that reading of Nietzsche. When you read Nietzsche's actual letters and comments and notes, however, that deal with this, what's particularly clear is that he thinks of this as the most terrifying thought possible. And it's hard to understand why that can be the case. Why does the Übermensch have to accept the doctrine of the eternal recurrence? Why is the eternal recurrence so terrifying? And it's terrifying, I think, because it really requires someone who is beyond good and evil, right? Nietzsche repeats this thought over and over again. I mean, he imagines that a few people will survive the thought, but that most people will simply commit suicide when they come to this thought. And it isn't just because the world makes no sense that this is the case, but that it is what it is, and we have to affirm that. So one way that I try to make clear what Nietzsche's thinking about, certainly for my students, is to say he imagines that to be perfectly affirmative, to not be dominated by a spirit of revenge against the past, either in the past or in the present, is you have to be willing to not only say, okay, everything that happened, I have to accept because of what I am, but that I have to will each of those things. And particularly, just to give one example that I use with my students, you have to say, I would turn on the gas valves at Auschwitz, right? I would, because I have to affirm that in order to be thoroughly affirmative and to escape from this notion of the causality of the past. So I think he thought that it was a terrifying and terrible thought, but a necessary thought, and that only the person that could accept that could create new values and serve the role that people like Mill and others thought was necessary. He just thought that they weren't radical enough. So if you look at the passage in Twilight of the Idols called Streifzüge eines unzeitgemäßigen, or Conflicts of an Untimely Man, he there compares himself to all of the other 19th century figures who one might mistake him for, in order to show that he's not these people, that he's different than them, that he really is a step beyond them in a really profound and fundamental way, and ultimately even beyond the two people at the end the three people that he thinks he most resembles, Goethe, Julius Caesar, and Napoleon. And, he says finally about Goethe, who people sometimes tend to identify as his model of the Übermensch, Goethe finally didn't understand the Dionysian, and he didn't therefore understand the Greeks. He didn't understand tragedy. He couldn't really, Faust had to be saved by God. He couldn't be the heroic character that Nietzsche imagined, and that Byron, for example, imagined that Faust could be. I think that he thinks his doctrine is terrifying and will have terrifying consequences. A lot of people want to argue that it's just a literary device. Naumas is probably at the forefront of this kind of reading. It's just Nietzsche is, his life is literature. He's creating literary characters, that the Übermensch is just a literary character. Nietzsche, however, says in his letters and notes, I know someday my doctrine is going to be responsible for the death of millions. So he had no illusions, I think, about the practical consequences of his thought, which were much more horrifying, I think, than most of his commentators want to imagine. Now, to be fair, most of them are trying to save him from some from being seen as the forefather of fascism and not Nazism, and I agree with that. But I think, because I think Nietzsche wouldn't have liked either one of those doctrines, but I think the fact that lots of people were going to die because of this thought was something that Nietzsche just simply accepted.
Yeah, and I want to get to that point in a second, because that comes up a couple times. I find myself in an unusual circumstance, because I totally agree with you in the criticism of the democratic character of against the democratic understanding or interpretation of the Übermensch, but I find myself resistant to that, to your reading of the ultimate conclusions. But I mean, just to back up for a second, I mean, I think one of the most helpful things that you're pointing to, I think reveals the way in which Nietzsche is attempting to humanize the idea of the Christian theodicy, right? So, you know, the idea of the problem of evil was a classic problem for Christian theologians, how to reconcile all the evils and the problems of the sin of the past. And to think that there's some kind of divine plan that even amidst the evils, those evils were themselves necessary and redeemed by the arrival of Christ or whatever. And you get versions of the same thing in Hegel, right? That in Hegel's philosophy of history, how do you sort of redeem the evils of the past? You have some kind of idea of a progressive spirit. And so in Nietzsche, you sort of have the destruction of all those things, no progressive philosophy of history, no sort of divine outside. So how do we achieve this kind of theodicy or redemption of the evils of the past? Yeah, and so the answer has to fall on the shoulders of some great human being who has to redeem humanity, who has this great comprehensive responsibility in that way. So that, I find that really useful, because I think it points towards, as you say, this sort of comprehensive responsibility that this kind of figure has, that it can't simply be a personal project of self-determination in the way somebody like Cavell wants it to be, but it has to be broad, comprehensive, and really humanistic. I mean, in my view, I guess it has to be, you know, one of the things the Übermensch is up to is to actually bring meaning to the life of humanity, to the path of humanity. It's not just for him himself, but it's for all. Even the little guy matters. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, I might rephrase it a little bit and say, it is the realization of a particular Christian notion that grows out of Occam and out of Luther. Nietzsche says at one point German philosophy is a, in a way, the child of the Lutheran minister's house. Both his father and both of his grandfathers were Lutheran ministers, so it clearly is self-referential in some sense as well. But I think what Nietzsche is pointing to there is something that is really intrinsic to Luther's thought. And we see this explicitly, as I pointed out in my earlier book on my Theological Origins of Modernity, that in his debate with Erasmus, Erasmus says to Luther, if you imagine God to be this powerful, then that God must also be responsible, not just for good, but for evil. And Luther says, well, yes, of course, that's the case. Now, you know, that in the Reformation tradition, that notion is in a way suppressed in later Reformation thinkers like Zwingli and Calvin, who actually are more moderate on that score than Luther is. But I think Nietzsche takes that point very seriously, which is to say, and Luther himself tries to avoid that by distinguishing between the revealed God and the hidden God. The hidden God may be responsible for good and evil, but the revealed God, i.e. Christ, is only responsible for good. And he encourages people to think only about the revealed God and not about the hidden God. The hidden God of Luther is what reemerges in Nietzsche's Thought as Dionysus, and as the basis for a new kind of view of religion in which a very human God, a God who dies and is reborn over and over again, it has to be over and over again. It isn't one final redemption for humanity in which now change takes place and everything, at least for the elect, has a happy ending. For Nietzsche, Nietzsche is not a Whig historian. There is no happy ending for Nietzsche. There is only a constant repetition of tragedy. And the important thing is to say yes to that, right? You'll probably remember in The Birth of Tragedy, at one point, he tells a story of King Midas capturing a satyr who was a companion of Dionysus, and King Midas says, "Well, what is the best possible life?" And the satyr tells him, "The best possible life is never to be born, and the next best thing is to die soon."
Right,
and that's I think at the core of Nietzsche's view of what the doctrine of the eternal recurrence, the Superman, has to overcome. He has to accept that notion that life doesn't have a goal, it doesn't have an ultimate meaning in itself, and that this is the special role, as you point towards, that humanity in a certain sense, but certainly the highest instances of humanity have to play, which is to say they have to be the ones that redeem everything that has occurred by saying yes to it, not just to the good things. It doesn't all end with a happy ending, but to all of the horrible things that have ever occurred. And that's what makes life and humanity special, I think, in Nietzsche's view, is this capacity to do that. It's not something that the animals can do. It certainly requires something like self-consciousness and reflection of our place in the world. It certainly requires a knowledge of death. And, you know, we see that over and over again in Zarathustra. But it also recognizes that even death isn't final. Death is not an escape from life. It's just one moment in a long, painful existence that has to be repeated over and over again. But an existence in which it's possible to attain something noble and glorious if we can accept that, and noble and glorious in the same sense that Oedipus could be noble and glorious, right? Guilty of a crime, but still in some sense rising above that.
Right. Yeah. This is all very helpful. I mean, I tend to think of the different, you know, divide the ways of reading the Übermensch into a couple different categories. I mean, one is the what we've been talking about, which is the Übermensch democratic or aristocratic in character? Another way to think about it is, what role does the Übermensch play? Is he simply a spiritual person, or is there also a political role that he plays? And the final way that I tend to sort of categorize this is, what's the sort of character of his activity? And I say his because Nietzsche talks about men. Is it predatory or redemptive? I mean, a lot of the ways that, you know, we've been talking about now, this is one of the reasons why I tend to think of the Nietzsche's sort of higher man as playing a role of caring for humanity, right? This is, I guess, maybe more the soft-hearted moment of my Nietzsche, which is to think of the sort of what the Übermensch is about is to sort of answer that, as you say, that the Silenus's challenge for humanity, not just for the Übermensch himself, but for all of humanity. And so there's a redemptive role, as opposed to there are a number of scholars who read the Übermensch in a predatory way. That is, that the many are so much cannon fodder or, you know, herd-like resources for the Übermensch to, extract for his own good. I couldn't tell from reading your book which side you stand on in that way, in that sort of debate between the sort of more predatory understanding or the more redemptive understanding.
I hate to say this, but I think both of those. And I try to bring that out by pointing several, on several occasions to the note in which Nietzsche describes the Übermensch as Caesar with the soul of Christ. And to be clear about what that means, it's probably important to remember that when Nietzsche says Christ, he does not mean the figure that is transmitted to us by Christianity, and particularly by Paul. Nietzsche imagined that as he says in the Antichrist, the last Christian died on the cross. And what he means by that is that the Christ was a thoroughly affirmative human being who accepted everything, including his own crucifixion. But that what happened to Christ was that Paul turned Christianity into a revenge religion that really went against the whole spirit of Christ. So when Nietzsche says Caesar with the soul of Christ, he means a Caesar who is not driven at all by a sense of revenge, by a hatred of the past in some sense, by a rejection of anything, but who accepts everything and who may act brutally in a whole variety of ways, but not because he wants to seek revenge against others or to injure others purposely, but just because it has to be done in order to institute and establish new values. But insofar as he does that, he isn't predatory in the sense, he isn't a blonde beast in the sense that Nietzsche talks about the earlier founders of civilization, because he's not just interested in his own glory. He's what Nietzsche sometimes calls an artist tyrant, someone who wants to sort of paint new colors for humanity. I actually think that the cover of my book in that sense captures the sort of colorfulness of Nietzsche that he ultimately was concerned with. But being Caesar with the soul of Christ means that he is going to be a political figure. He is going to actually be a conqueror. Nietzsche imagined that such people could only come into being as a result of a long 200-year period of war and destruction. They had to be hardened, and they had to be hardened against pity, in his view. And obviously something that he himself was incapable of. And this hardening effect against pity was, however, in Nietzsche's view, not pity for the mass of humanity that would have to suffer as a result of this, but pity for what he calls the higher men and the fate of the higher men. And this, the higher men, in his view, were people like Dostoevsky, Goethe, Napoleon, others who had to perish because they weren't strong enough to do what was necessary. We see this in Zarathustra in part four, where these higher men that include figures like Schopenhauer, Stendhal, and others in masks are simply not Zarathustra's companions, right? They're not high enough. And the image that comes about at the end of Zarathustra that captures this, I think, is that what's sometimes called the sign of the appearance of Zarathustra's children, and that is a lion surrounded by a flock of doves, which is to say, Caesar surrounded by the birds of Christ.
I don't want to finish without talking about your couple chapters on Nietzsche's new logic, or poetic or musical logic, which were really excellent chapters, because you read Twilight of the Idols and Ecce Homo both as having a musical structure to them, particularly the structure of a sonata, which I found totally fascinating. I mean, I remember the chapter on Twilight of the Idols comes from your previous previous in the Nietzsche's New Seas volume, but I think you reworked it here, and the Ecce Homo is new to me. And I found them to be excellent, you know, one of the best readings of those individual books. I mean, it sort of really unlocked the structure in a way that scholars, I think, haven't noticed in a really sort of interesting way. Maybe you could say a little bit about why Nietzsche constructs these works along musical lines and why he chooses the sonata in particular.
What is particularly important for Nietzsche in his in the later period is his rejection of Wagnerianism and of Wagner. And it's really important because he wants to show people that he is not just a continuation of the whole Wagnerian enterprise, which most people probably associated him with. You know, it's important to think a little bit about the publication history of Nietzsche's works. I mean, Nietzsche's first work, The Birth of Tragedy, had a widespread reception. But after that, increasingly fewer people actually read or reviewed his work. So Nietzsche was largely unknown to the European public until 1888 and 1889. And as a result, he, for example, wanted to delay the publication of Ecce Homo, which he saw as the sort of crucial last step before his producing his magnum opus. He wanted to delay that until he wrote another book that was a collection of his earlier essays called Nietzsche Contra Wagner, to show people that he wasn't a Wagnerian again. So part of not being a Wagnerian has a kind of practical purpose in terms of getting people to understand who he is and who he's not. But it's also connected with a transformation away from what he thought was essential to Wagnerian music, was the notion of infinite melody, which is simply as he saw it, a kind of musical logic that simply appeals to momentary passions, but that doesn't ultimately lead to any kind of hierarchy or order of rank among those passions. So that you could, in listening to Wagnerian music, you could go through one rapture after another, but it didn't really lead anywhere, in his view. Now, we know from a musical point of view that Nietzsche probably didn't understand that Wagner himself was using these titanic orchestral forms in his melodies, but practically the experience of Wagnerian music was much more as Nietzsche understood it, because most people certainly didn't understand the way in which themes came back and were reconstituted. And it took us a hundred years in any case to come to terms with the way in which that occurred. Nietzsche believes that the classical sonata form and particularly Mozart and others captured that ability to make meaningful distinctions into something like a whole. So he uses that in both. I think he uses musical forms in lots of his later works. I only talk about it with respect to Twilight of the Idols and Ecce Homo. But he uses these musical forms to try to give structure to his thought. And the sonata form is particularly useful in the sense that it provides him with a basis for looking for establishing themes that are of importance, but that are contradictory with one another, and then developing those in the development section, and then in the recapitulation, showing how they can be reconciled with one another. So in Twilight of the Idols, he really wants to talk about three different themes first of all, in European history as a whole, philosophy, morality, and politics. But then within, and by that he means the Greeks, the Christians, and the Germans. But then more specifically in the development form, the way that occurs in the 19th century, which in which he looks at the French, the English, and the Germans to show how all of those can be reconciled finally by a return back to the Greeks. And, but it's a return in a certain sense back to the Greeks, but it's the meaning of the Greeks for us today. So it is the new Hellenism that Nietzsche believes has to be founded based upon his notion of the Dionysian, which he identifies with the doctrine of the eternal recurrence.
One of the things I was trying to understand is the, you know, so is music for Nietzsche sort of part of the structure of the world? And that's why he wanted to write in a sort of having the form of music. So you can't, you know, for Nietzsche, going back to his early work, a conceptual approaches to the world sort of distorted or misunderstand it. And so, you know, sort of more artistic or musical approach to the world is, you know, better captures what's going on. Or is the idea something like, well, we need to, you know, express, or Nietzsche needs to, you know, employ music in order to reform and rearrange a fundamentally unmusical world, right? To bring together what's essentially a sort of dissonant world into a kind of order.
Well, I think I would say both of those things. In this sense, uh-huh. If we look at his early thought when he is when he's thinking about the role of that music can play. And he identifies it there with what he then calls the Dionysian as opposed to the Apollinian. The Apollinian is the imagistic, or then ultimately the conceptual, which is the world in which we usually live. We think that words actually describe the world. Nietzsche in Zarathustra tells us that words are dream bridges among things that remain eternally separate, right? That, and in Twilight and in The Birth of Tragedy, he tells us that in a way words are ultimately an expression of music. That we, you know, in like Rousseau, he believed that we human beings began with music, by singing, by making sounds that then came to later have some specific meaning or referent in the world, but that what's happened is that we have lost that sense of the musicality of things, and we have become captured by the conceptual of the world, by what he refers to there as either a Socratic culture or a Hellenistic way of looking at things. The lure of words, however, is something that ultimately, in his view, misleads us. What we need to do is we need to recognize the insufficiency of words in coming to terms with what's ultimately real. And here, in the Twilight of the Idols, Birth of Tragedy, he makes an important point that I think he continues to carry through his entire thought, which is we can talk about a world will or a will to power or will in some sense, but will is just a word that stands in for or tries to conceptualize what he there calls primordial music, right? Which he identifies with Dionysus. You know, I think he carries that through now. Does that mean we should go back to a simply musical understanding of things? Nietzsche, at the end of The Birth of Tragedy, says, no, what's necessary is a Socrates who practices music, or a Dionysian Socrates. And I see that ultimately as Nietzsche's goal, right? He doesn't end up, he writes plenty of music in his later thought, and while it's been derided by lots of people, some recent research has shown that it is a kind of attempt to realize his ideas. So it ends up not being great music in the classical sense, but it ends up being great music in terms of doing what Nietzsche wants music to do, which is to combine it with words. And I think that in writing these books, he tries to do the same thing. We don't give up on conceptualism, but it has to be underpinned by a musical kind of logic that will shape people, whether or not they understand the language and the concepts at all. And I think this is why, I think this is one of the explanations for Nietzsche's incredible appeal, over time to readers. It is just the musicality of his speech. And if you look at his own account of some of the passages that he wrote, you know, he thinks that, you know, he'll read a passage and he'll, you know, he'll weep for hours on end over the beauty of it. So I think he felt that that's what it should do. And I think, you know, part of the evidence for that is the incredible impact that it's had over time. And, you know, it's important to remember, and he's thinking particularly here of Zarathustra, but you know, it's important to remember that Zarathustra sold more copies than all other philosophical works put together. So it had a tremendous impact. And, you know, any of us should be so lucky to realize even, you know, a small bit of that. But I think a lot of that just has to do with Nietzsche's kind of strange musical poetic language that seems so unique and strange to us. It's hard to think of anything, you know, before that even comes close to that. But there are obviously lots of imitators afterwards.
Yeah, that's great. And this even holds for Nietzsche's account of himself, which is something you stress in Ecce Homo, that it has as a musical character. I mean, Nietzsche throughout his life really engaged in this practice of sort of self-reflection. And this was something, of course, famously in the Genealogy of Morals, he says, "We remain unknown to ourselves, we knowers," that, you know, there's a deep problem of self-knowledge that Nietzsche sees, but yet in some ways, I think one of the strengths of your interpretation here is to point out the ways in which something like a musically or poetically inflected self-reflection can get at self-knowledge better than simply more conceptual analysis or something like that. That Ecce Homo possessing that structure to sort of weave together the contradictions of himself, I suppose, or his different contributions can capture his own personality better than a more standard autobiography. Is that right?
Well, yeah, and I think in ways that you know, maybe Nietzsche himself doesn't entirely understand. And I think one way I like to think about this is, if you go to listen to classical music, even if you reasonably understand the musical structures and the chord changes, and you can count measures and all kinds of things, almost everybody in a classical conference, in a classical music performance, has images that pop into their minds when they're hearing music that seem to come out of nowhere. And, you know, I think that's part of what Nietzsche's getting at, that music evokes, you know, we try to comprehend it, but we try to comprehend it in terms of images, or images are brought to mind by music. So I think part of Nietzsche's, part of the appeal to Nietzsche is the musicality of his language. You know, it was after reading Zarathustra that I decided I needed to learn German. And you know, if you look at any of Nietzsche's poetry, you know, it's not conceptually brilliant. You know, it reflects a lot of what he has, but it captures in its musical structures a lot of, I think, what Nietzsche ultimately is about. That said, it is, you know, I don't think in that sense he entirely escapes from the romanticism of his own musical tastes.
Yeah, it's interesting on that point about his poetry. I just reviewed the the new Nietzsche Kommentar on the Nietzsche's idols from Messina, which, you know, again, I mean, Nietzsche's poetry, it's just not something we usually political theorists or philosophers pay much attention to. But I was struck in looking at that. I mean, the author of the Kommentar writes how, you know, Nietzsche is now regarded as one of the greatest German lyric poets, yeah. Which I know. I mean, it's really striking.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, and for many years, I mean, people have said Nietzsche's poetry and music, you should just neglect those altogether because they don't have any, you know, they're pedestrian at best. But I think that just underrated Nietzsche in all kinds of ways. And I hope that the, you know, coming to terms with the profundity of Nietzsche's thought and with what I call his anti-metaphysics is really something that will help open up the possibility for coming to understand that. Although, you know, I have to say I'm a little bit reluctant to hope that people become too moved by Nietzsche. Again, since I don't think the conclusions that he comes to are either as inevitable as he imagines or as positive as he hoped.
Well, so that gets to your final chapter, which is called What Remains. And I take it what you mean by what remains is, number one, what Nietzsche left remaining of his final teaching, right? So Nietzsche didn't complete his magnum opus in the way he left sketches of it, but didn't complete it. But I also take it what you mean by what remains is what's alive and what's dead in Nietzsche's thought, or what should be alive and what should be dead in Nietzsche's thought. Maybe you could say a little bit. I mean, you go through a number of assumptions in Nietzsche's assumptions and challenge them in the conclusion. You want to say a little bit about, you know, your thought of the last thought you left us with, which is the, you know, sort of you're hoping he doesn't become too enchanting. So what do you think? What do you think is the most problematic aspect of Nietzsche's thought?
Well, I think we obviously have to face the question of whether or not Nietzsche himself was able to complete his final teaching. And that's the magnum opus that was, you know, that all of this work was planned to culminate in. And, you know, it's not clear that, number one, that he could have completed it. He certainly didn't complete it. He certainly didn't complete it in the way his sister's edition, you know, misrepresents him as having completed. But I'm not convinced that it was completable. And, but that said, it may not have been completable for a whole variety of reasons that have to do with Nietzsche himself, with his lack of a scientific education that he hoped to obtain, with his sense of his inability to overcome the problem of pity. You know, the legend is that he, which is probably at least closely true, that he died throwing his arms around, he went insane dying, throwing his arms around a horse to keep it from being, beaten by its master. It may just be that he was too ill, that he had, as I try to point out in there, probably something like a right orbital meningioma, which is a tumor behind the right eye that just caused intense pain and suffering. Those are all practical reasons to imagine that it couldn't be completed. The other is simply a question of whether he was right about human anthropology and whether we are as malleable and unshapen by nature as Nietzsche imagines that we are. I think probably he's wrong about that. That there is a natural component to our existence that shapes lots of what we do, as well as a cultural component. I mean, he put great weight upon, much greater weight upon culture than I think most people would be comfortable with today in any case. That said, it's hard not to take seriously Nietzsche's cautions about bourgeois society and the nihilism and consumerism that seem to be so dominant in modern society. And more so because we tend not to have external modes of validation that are universally accepted. So you know, you know, this is a problem that's obviously evident in our own political situation today. The I think that Nietzsche finally was unable to complete his work, but that what he left for us was, in a certain sense, a huge problem. Because he points out so clearly the defects of our own way of life, but then points us towards a solution that seems to be perfectly unacceptable to almost everybody. And so I think, you know, while we can reject his solution, we have to be cognizant of the problem and the depth of the problem that he points out to us. Otherwise we remain sort of people who occasionally delve into Nietzsche's works in order to get a thrill or some kind of inspiration, but without taking him with sufficient seriousness.
Well, this has been a great conversation, Michael. I always love talking about Nietzsche. I myself encountered Nietzsche when I was a young person and then stuck with him. So, and I think have tried to maintain a healthy distance. So, but I always enjoy talking about Nietzsche, and certainly talking about Nietzsche with you, Michael. So thanks so much for joining me.
Great. Good. Take care.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.